Verne's other writing on the desert island theme. One law of the Robinsonade genre is to include claims as to the excessive easiness of the predecessors. Another law is that influence is visible not only directly, but also because each previous work imitates and deconstructs the previous works, and so on, back to the version, or even beyond. A third law is that each new volume claims, nevertheless, to have discovered a novel situation. Verne follows all three laws, but often in unexpected ways. Throughout his career, Verne wrote a great deal on desert islands in both the fictional and non-fictional mode. However, the constraints of his reputation as a writer for young people, as well as his own personal inclination, mistrustful of any theorizing, mean that his observations are usually down to earth. The value, then, for understanding Mysterious Island is in the information provided about such central ideas as social structure, the viability of living alone, and the concrete details of survival, especially fire, food, and shelter. Although Verne never repeats himself, the same concerns do frequently reoccur. At the age of 10 or 11, his dreams already concern lost islands and rediscovered paradises, at least according to his 63-year-old self. In discussing the Robinsonade, we must be careful, however, not to be influenced by modern hedonistic conceptions of hot climates, sunbathing, unpolluted skies, and beautiful natives. For Verne, the essential attractions of islands are exploration of undiscovered territory and the new social relations that arise. The novelist, in fact, prefers cold and wet climates to an almost masochistic degree. His dream is invariably to head towards the poles, if possible, via his beloved Scotland. In addition, the attraction of the Vernian Robinsonade is conditioned by an awareness that the number of lost islands is finite, that they are all destined to be annexed, sooner or later, by the nations of the Old and New Worlds. The most important information appears in Verne's Memories of Childhood and Youth, written in about 1891. One day I was alone in a bad skiff without a keel. 10 leagues downstream from Chantenay, a plank broke and the water started pouring in. Impossible to stop the leak. I was now in distress. The skiff sank straight down, and I barely had time to throw myself onto an islet adorned with great dense reeds and plumes bent by the wind. Now, in all the books of my childhood, the one that I particularly liked was The Swiss Family Robinson, more than Robinson Crusoe. I know full well that Daniel Defoe's work has more philosophical depth. It is about a man abandoned to himself, a man alone, a man who one day finds the mark of a naked foot on the sand. But the work of Vies, rich in information and adventures, is more interesting for young brains. It's the family. Father, mother, and children with their diverse abilities. How many years I spent on their island. I was irresistibly pushed to portray the Robinsons of science and knowledge in the Mysterious Island, and a whole boarding school of Robinsons in School for Robinsons. But meanwhile, on my isle, it was the heroes of Daniel Defoe who were incarnated in my person. Already I was thinking of building a hut from branches, making a line from a reed, using thorns as hooks, and making fire as savages do, by rubbing together 2 pieces of dry wood. Signals? I wouldn't make any, for they might be noticed too soon, and I would be saved more quickly than I wanted. First of all, it was advisable to satisfy my hunger. How? My provisions had sunk in the shipwreck. Go hunting for birds? I had neither dog nor gun. Well, what about shellfish? There weren't any. In the end, consequently, I knew the suffering of abandonment and the horrors of destitution on a desert island, as felt by the Selkirks and other characters from Naufrage Célèbre, who were not imaginary Robinsons. My stomach cried out. It only lasted a few hours, and as soon as the tide had gone out, I simply had to cross with water up to my ankles to reach what I called the mainland, the right bank of the Loire, and so I had to be content with a family dinner rather than the meal a la Crusoe I had dreamed of. Raw shellfish, a slice of peccary, and bread made from manioc flour. The information in this mini-autobiography is a revealing mixture of enthusiastic naivete and knowing rehearsal of the age-old myth of escape to a distant shore, visible and mysterious island, but also the long line of predecessors who have already worn out much of the genre. The essential opposition is between Defoe's independence and Weis's cozy domesticity. Another important revelation is made in Jules Verne at Home by Marie A. Belloc, The Strand Magazine, February 1895. And yet perhaps I shall shock you by admitting that I myself prefer the dear old Swiss Family Robinson to Defoe. People forget that Crusoe and his man Friday were but an episode in a 7-volume story. To my mind, the book's great merit is that it was apparently the first romance of a kind ever written. I never tire of Fenimore Cooper. Certain of his romances will, I trust, be remembered long after the so-called literary giants of later ages are forgotten. Then again, I thoroughly enjoy Captain Marryat's breezy romances. Owing to my unfortunate inability to read English, I am not so familiar as I should like to be with Mayne Reid and Robert Louis Stevenson. Still, I was greatly delighted with the latter's Treasure Island. But Verne's thinking on the desert island theme comes out most clearly in his works before Mysterious Island. In Captain Grant's Children, Harry relates, "We began like Defoe's ideal Robinson, our model, by collecting the flotsam from the ship, the tools, a little powder, some firearms, and a bag of precious seeds. The first few days were very difficult, but hunting and fishing soon afforded us a sure supply of food, for wild goats abounded in the interior of the island and marine animals on the coasts. By degrees, our life became regular and organized." In the same novel, Paganel and Lady Helena debate the ideas of happiness and isolation on a desert island. The Frenchman argues that a kid or an eloquent parrot or amiable monkey are sufficient. "And if a lucky chance sends one a companion like the faithful Friday, what more is needed? Two friends on a rock, there is happiness." But Lady Helena counters, "You are thinking of the life of an imaginary Robinson thrown on a carefully selected island and treated by nature like a spoiled child. Man is made for society, and solitude can only engender despair. When death comes, which utter loneliness will render terrible, he will be like the last man on the last day of the world. Believe me, Monsieur Paganel, such a man is not to be envied." Just as Harry defines the material conditions governing every Robinsonade, thus announcing the structure of Part One of Mysterious Island, so Paganel reflects both Defoe and the 11-year-old Verne, while Lady Helena anticipates Nemo's final dilemma of dying alone. 20,000 Leagues also informs Verne's attraction to islands. The opening chapter is entitled A Shifting Reef, and emphasizes the parallels between shoals, sea monsters, and submarines. Indeed, floating islands and shifting reefs are an obsession in The Extraordinary Journeys, undoubtedly due to the writer's childhood overlooking the moving sandbanks of the Loire. Guerberora Island, possibly Gaba Island or Gilboa in 20,000 Leagues, contains many similarities with the Mysterious Island. For a couple of days, the guests, prisoners, escape the oppressive atmosphere of the Nautilus to find exotic fauna and flora, breadfruit and barbecued meat in a tropical paradise, which again echoes Weis and Defoe. Even after Mysterious Island, Verne comes back obsessively to the theme, but with an increasing tendency towards parody and self-destruction. On 7th November 1874, the novelist wrote to Ritt, director of the Théâtre de la Porte Saint-Martin, presenting his plans for a play called Captain Grant's Children. The first draft was written by 1876, and the play was performed and published in 1878. De Boer is replaced by the imaginary Balker Isle of the Southern Seas, situated not far from Adélie coast. Like De Boer at 37 degrees south, but with the longitude moved to 165 degrees west. The Mutineers of the Bounty, 1879, ends with an idyllic description of the colony on Pitcairn, mixing Old Testament traditionalism with a Rousseauist primitivism, of which Cyrus Smith would surely have disapproved. The girls, above all, were admirably beautiful. Money was unknown. All transactions were done by means of exchange, but there was no industry, for there were no raw materials. The only clothes worn by the inhabitants were vast hats and grass skirts. Pitcairn Island has become the motherland of a gentle, hospitable, and happy population, amongst which prevail the patriarchal customs of the First Age. Verne calls The School for Robinsons, 1882, a false Robinson. In trenchantly rejecting Etzel's criticism of the manuscript, Verne echoes memories of childhood and youth. "It seems to me that the philosophical depth you want to indicate is completely outside my subject and of a nature to weigh it down." The book satirizes the desert island genre. A rich American buys an island to cure his nephew of dreaming of Robinsons, and places an implausible collection of animals on it, together with actors to play savages. A shipwreck is set up, which forces the hero to look after an eccentric teacher of dancing and deportment. Even the illiterate natives behave as if they have read Defoe. However, the island is then really invaded by wild animals, undermining the parody. 2 Years Vacation, 1888, and Second Homeland, 1900, are the only novels of Verne's to which he provided prefaces. In 2 Years Vacation, a group of 15 British, American, and French boys are shipwrecked on the authentic Hanover Island off South America. They discover a new castaway, a woman, and from Robinsons, they become settlers, setting up a school. But soon national rivalries emerge, resulting in some of the British seceding until pirates force them back. The novel is full of implausibilities. The youth of the protagonists, the lack of care by the ship's crew, the single rope attaching the ship to Auckland Quay, the fact that they cannot see the neighboring islands, and the variety of fauna and flora, including even hippopotami. Second Homeland presents itself as a sequel to The Swiss Family Robinson, with the first chapters summarizing Wiese's novel. Imitating the Swiss castaways, one of the boys tries to ride various animals, including an ostrich, but with a comic lack of success. However, the heroes do not have the same personalities as in Wiese, and contemporary reality has meanwhile moved on. In both this novel and Mysterious Island, the characters discuss the difficult transition from a small group of settlers to a full-scale colony, as happens with tragic results in Cooper's The Crater and Verne's In the Magallanes, 1987. The three later Robinsonades fail to recapture the magical pioneering adventures of Mysterious Island. But, of course, the Mysterious Island carries within it the limits of paradise, the unique and implausible circumstances of its founding, its uncertain future, if ever revealed to the world, and the impossibility of escaping the rest of humanity or the demons of the past. The three self-pastiches merely emphasize the paradoxes intrinsic to Verne's desert islands.